Welcome, everyone, to Preaching the Great Stories of Genesis. On the back of one, the copy that's, largely white on the front, there's a wonderful bibliography, and from time to time as we move throughout this class, I'm going to be passing out some of these resources to you, because they're wonderful, and they may be some that you've already found on your own, maybe some that you have never even thought about using before, but they're all really rich and great for both teaching and for preaching Genesis, the book of Genesis. A couple other things. I'm going to be playing some music throughout today throughout this hour from a group that maybe some of you haven't heard of, the Mountain Goats. Yeah, they're better than the name is. And then also using a little clip from a series that the Methodist Church puts out on Genesis, their discipleship models. Have anybody used disciple model in your church? It's wonderful. So I'll talk a little bit about that too. Let's start by just talking a little bit about why Genesis. Because Genesis tends to be that book of the Bible that either people are arguing over, you know, about did it really happen? Is it really a six-day creation? So everybody's getting apoplectic about it. Or it's a book that we think we know so well. You know, don't we all know the stories of Jacob and Esau? Don't we all know what happened in the garden? So the mere familiarity that we have with Genesis, I think, can really impair our ability to read this book fresh. But I think a fresh reading of this book is really necessary, especially if you're serving in communities that are multicultural, if you're in a neighborhood that has much religious diversity. Leading a study group on Genesis and inviting, you know, the Jewish neighbors from down the block and maybe the Muslim who lives a couple of blocks away, this is a wonderful opportunity to really engage in some robust discussion around what does it mean to be people of the book. Today I'm really going to focus on the context of using it in our own churches and primarily focused on teaching it and preaching it. A couple of things. Genesis is both the books or the book of Genesis is about the people of Genesis, and we all get that. But larger than that, it's also the book about a nation. And I think that's the key point to remember on the front end, that the people of Genesis, like all great literature, they stand for more than just themselves. So Esau stands for Edom, for this country that's going to be against Israel at different points in its history. You know, there's these other larger shadows that every character in these stories are standing in front of. And I think we do our churches a disservice when we don't allow those stories to operate on the big stage that they're really called to operate on. As we have used this, and I'm sorry, this is kind of a rambling introduction. I will get to, like, the points. One of the ways that we have used Genesis in our own church is to try to find common ground for people. We have a lot of folks who are returning to faith or who are kind of post-evangelical in their own way. That's our own ministry setting. And so they come with a lot of skepticism, and they come fearing the God of the Old Testament, the raging, angry God of the Old Testament as they see it. They see that everything starts somehow with Jesus. And to be able to read the Old Testament, and especially the Pentateuch books, and Genesis in particular, and to read it through an eye of what God was already doing is a profound gift to people like that. You know, it helps them, especially if you were there last night and heard Marva Don exegete the Akedah story. That's what we all need to be doing. You know, we need to be able to go deeper than just our unsettledness that's often on the surface for us, because we hear about, you know, God telling them to slaughter some group or do this, that, and the other, and it's hard for us with our 21st century, feelings to kind of go back and look at that honestly and see what's really going on in the text. There's a couple of ways, I think, of moving into the text, and I want to open by using this little clip, because one of the best resources to use when you're approaching Genesis are Jewish resources. There's no escaping that the rabbis have been talking and kibitzing on Genesis long before we entered the picture. And they have some rich literature around that, rich, robust conversation around that. So I want to just show you this one little clip, and maybe we should just turn off the lights to kind of get our imaginative juices going here. course, now I have to figure out. Let's see. This is actually a New Testament prof who's looking at Genesis through a Jewish scholar's eyes. Maybe.
Well, the temptation story is one that's, of course, is so foundational to our understanding of the Bible. And it's one that Christians are typically very, very familiar with. They may not be as familiar, of course, with how important that story has been for the Jewish tradition. So maybe you can help us understand that a bit.
Well, the rabbis approach things a little differently. When we tend to ask the question, what does the story mean? They tend to ask, to what shall we compare this story? A different question, metaphorical question. The same question, by the way, that Jesus asks again and again. To what shall we compare the reign of God? When we tend to see the Bible as a kind, or studying the Bible as a kind of narrowing process of getting to the one kernel of truth, they tend to see it as a broadening process, seeing the Bible as a book that can apply to absolutely any human experience, but it has to be interpreted within that experience. So in looking at the temptation story, that's what the rabbis tend to do. They tend to look at how this applies to the vast human experience that they know, both in their own congregations, their own communities, and in their experience of the world, and in the context of the whole Bible. So, for example, they look at names, the name of God. Something gets added in this second creation story. In the first creation, they note the designation of God tends to be Elohim. Here, it tends to be Elohim Adonai. Well, we might explain it a different way. They say, well, Elohim refers to God's justice. Adonai refers to God's mercy. We didn't need God's mercy until this second story. We didn't need God's mercy until the temptation, and we took this creation, which God had called good, and broke it. And so they look at those subtle changes in names, subtle changes in imagery, and try to find comparisons between the names and things we can identify with.
A very careful reading, attention to detail, rather than, you're saying, maybe a Christian tendency, which is to look for the one overall message of the story. And of course, when we talk about the history of the Jewish tradition, they did read it in Hebrew.
That's right.
Not in English.
Absolutely.
And there are things that pop out at you also in just reading the story in Hebrew that you might not catch in English, right?
Well, an example of that is the Hebrew word for naked and the Hebrew word for clever or shrewd, naked applied to the humans, clever or shrewd applied to the serpent, are very similar words. It would be kind of like our saying, the people were nude and the serpent was shrewd.
Yeah.
It would be that kind of comparison. They note that. And so when they look at the serpent, of course, Satan gets brought into that story later on. But in the original story, the serpent isn't a symbol of evil so much as the clever one, the one who's smarter than the human beings, the trickster figure. I like to teasingly say the only one who had a theological education, because when he meets the woman, starts a theological argument. And when he does that, he gets his facts wrong. Intentionally or unintentionally, he says, why did God tell you not to eat from any of the trees? God hadn't said that. So the woman, Eve, corrects him. God said we could eat from any of the trees, except one, the tree in the middle of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If we eat from that one, even if we touch it, we'll die. God hadn't said that touching part either, but she was, as the rabbis say, she was putting a hedge around the Torah. You can't eat what you don't touch.
Well, for Christians, what is the result of this temptation? And maybe compare that then to Jewish interpretation, the result of this temptation.
Well, we're probably pretty familiar in the Christian tradition with the result, original sin. For most of us, our sinning's not very original. So we have to go back to Augustine and some of those early writers to figure out what does that mean. Well, if in the first of the creation stories, God creates everything and calls it good. In this second story, it's broken, and we break it. Humans break it, in essence. And in that breaking, Augustine saw something that got transferred down throughout the generations. A sin that was Adam's, that then got along the line of his descendants, all the way down to you and me, transmitted to us. Now, in the Jewish tradition, it's a very different approach. There's no sense of original sin as such. Now, that's not to deny that people are sinful or that we have a tendency to do bad things. That's acknowledged. Perhaps an image that's helpful. In the Jewish tradition, the nakedness of Adam and Eve is that they are not clothed in good deeds. They don't need to be. But once things are broken, once they make that one decision that leads to all these other decisions, that opens the door to making bad decisions, then they need to clothe themselves. And the old rabbis say they clothe themselves in mitzvot, good deeds. And so when we hear about a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah, it simply means that that youngster has come to an age where they can make those kinds of choices for the good or for the bad, and they are encouraged to clothe themselves in good deeds. So instead of a sense of everyone somehow having this sin transmitted along the line, the way Christians tend to see it, they see sin as a tendency that's natural to human beings, but not woven into the very fabric of who we are. We can choose to do the good as well as choose to do the bad, or clothe ourselves in righteousness, good deeds.
Thanks. Interesting, isn't it? And I wanted to show that near the beginning because I think you don't have to agree. You know, we can all leave here if we agree already with the total depravity and Augustine's idea of sin being transmuted all along the line. We can go away agreeing with that. But this opens our imaginations to different ways of looking at that garden scene, different ways of understanding what really happened there. There's an interesting midrash on the text written by a rabbi in the 1500s where he talks about the inevitability of the I think he called it the wager that God had put out there. That, you know, how do you learn how not to do something? I mean, you tell your child, don't touch that. And what do they do? I mean, right? It's this instinctiveness that we have to do the very thing we're told not to do. And so this rabbi is examining this and reading it through this human experience lens and imagines that the garden scene, the temptation, the fall scene is inevitable because there's a certain amount of innocence that you only move beyond after you've done something wrong. It's after you touch the hot stove that you think, ooh, not going to do that again. You know, it's after you've broken the vase that you were told not to touch. And so there's a certain amount of adulthood that goes on post Adam and Eve in the garden scene. Now, again, you don't have to agree with that. It's not about changing our theological positions. It's about moving into a place where you're engaging robustly with the text. And before we start engaging robustly with the text, you can bet that the mom who's just trying to get dinner on the table and the dad who comes home exhausted, they're not going to engage with the text. This is one means, and I'll pass this around in a bit, but this whole, this was a clip by the United Methodists, as I mentioned, this discipleship model. But it's a wonderful way of you just being reintroduced to some of these great stories. There's another good way, too. The midrashes are well known, well documented. You can find them in a lot of places. You can also find them in some really good Jewish work. The New Interpreter Study Bible is wonderful in terms of their notes. This is, you know, a wonker of a Bible because I've got the Apocrypha in there, you know, which I, of course, never read, but I felt like I needed to have it. So I've added an extra 2 pounds to it. But it has wonderful study notes that are from a real variety of sources. Another source, if you've never engaged with the Jewish Publication Society, they are terrific. And this, the Jewish Study Bible, JPS Tanaka, is a terrific, again, a wonderful, wonderful translation of the text, a very literal translation, and wonderful study helps. They're not trying to find Jesus in this. They're trying to find, I know we've all been there, right? And sometimes it's a stretch. But you feel like you got to do it. Well, these guys don't have to do it. You know, they can just read the text as it is. And because they believe that God is calling them as faithful rabbis to engage with him, then they'll argue it down. And it's wonderful. And it starts to awaken you to, well, maybe this is a little different than I thought, you know? This is a new translation by Robert Alter. Robert Alter taught, University of California, Berkeley. He actually has a whole five-volume Pentateuch on this. But his work on Genesis is tremendous. This is a wonderful translation. And again, with wonderful study notes, and this is cheap. You know, the other one costs, but this is like $15 or something. Really well worth it. I don't know if they ordered any of these books, but I mentioned to them I thought they would be great resources. Let's look at another story, a story that maybe we're so accustomed to seeing it in one way, you know, that maybe the blinders are over our eyes a bit. It's the one that you have there. Let's see, which ones do we have? We have 18, don't we, or 16? Yeah. Let's just look at chapter 16. I'm going to try and find one up here because I want to read the same one you guys are reading. Yeah. Somebody want to volunteer to just read, you know, 1 to 5, and then somebody else read 6 to 10, and then somebody read 11 to 15? Yeah, please. Yeah, thanks.
Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me."
"The servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count."
The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." That is why Uel was called Lahai-Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael.
If you were to approach this text and try to read it fresh, you know, like, okay, this is not the beginning of, you know, Islam, this is, you know, something else going on here. If you were to approach it really with wholly different eyes, name some of those ways. Name some of the people that you might be looking at that you've never even noticed before, or maybe a geographical setting that you would never have noticed before. Anything kind of pop out? Yeah.
Looking at things from Hagar's perspective.
Wouldn't that be interesting, huh? Yeah. Looking at things from Hagar's perspective. Yes, sir.
Some people aren't even happy, but they get what they want.
That would be a good sermon. Yeah. Sarai's position, she's not happy, right? She even got what she wanted. She's not happy. Some other things? How about that, the henpecked husband, right? What about that angle? That would be interesting, huh?
And yet the husband, verse 6, who says to the wife, you know, this was your idea in the first place, you deal with consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that interesting? And you know, just piggybacking on that, that's very similar to what we see in the garden.
Yeah.
Right? This blame shifting is a repeated motif of Genesis. Yeah, go ahead.
And then go to Isaac and say the same thing.
That's a really interesting angle. Yeah, the brothers' motif, and we're going to talk a little bit around that exact point in just a second. You see this brother rivalry stuff happening again and again and again. Of course, we see it in the garden with Cain and Abel, and we see the result of that, that it results in murder. But after that, we still get this bitterness, this hatred between brothers, and yet after Cain and Abel, it's not resolved with death. Some other comments? Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And just to comment on that too, there's some, Marva Don last night said you look for the things that repeat in the text. You also look for the geographical, moments, and you look at them throughout scripture. Because that well is very important, and where they stop on the road to Shur is the same point that the Israelites stop after they're fleeing, in the Exodus story. So, you know, these stories, and remember, Genesis was not a standalone book, right? It was, I mean, we truncated it. People down the line truncated it, but it was just part of the five-volume set, right? I mean, you're heading on. You're not just stopping on Genesis. You're moving into the Exodus and the laws of Leviticus. Yeah, some, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that would be good. Yeah. And tying that in with names and what they mean throughout Genesis. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Right. 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 That's right. Mm-hmm. Despised and threatened. She's deeply threatened now by the pregnant Hagar, right? And I think this story is really good because all the things that we have just noted here, we all started with felt need. I think that's a big challenge whenever you're preaching or teaching Genesis, is that these folks tend to be larger than life, you know, the patriarchs, the people of the stained glass windows. And if you start with a felt need, with Sarah feeling less than a woman, or Ishmael thinking, man, what's up with this? I didn't ask for this, you know? Or Hagar feeling like, why are you dissing me? I only did what I was told to do. You know, when you start from that position, you end up in a very different place around Genesis, I think. You end up with a place where people can really see themselves in these big stories. You know, they're not larger than life figures. They're people just like us. You know, there's that great quote that Jim Wallace uses in his book, God's Politics, where he says, you know, we always think, actually he's quoting Annie Dillard from Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, if anybody's familiar with that book, but he says, you know, we always think that there was this age that was more heroic, that was somehow grander and bigger than us. But the reality is that there's never been anybody but us chickens. That's all there's ever been. You know, and it was a chicken. It was a chicken Abraham that believed that God had actually called him and stepped out. It's a chicken Sarai who believes somehow this promise means something. And I don't know. I don't have enough word on it, so I'm going to step out and I'm going to do this thing, you know. I think if we keep unreeling the story back to felt need, real people, then we're well on our way to making these stories sing more for our congregations. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was always chosen.
Mm-hmm. And I never knew if I was chosen. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yep. Right. And you know, that gets back to that thing we just said at the beginning, that this is how the Jews understood themselves. All these stories. This is how we understand our place before God. You know, 21st century Americans, we look back and we're looking at the historical record and whether it happened, and we're answering all these criticisms. For them, this was a great story of being chosen. We were nobody, and God made something of us. Sarah was nobody but an old hag, and God did something. You know, Abraham was nobody but this guy in Teshuvah, until God says, let me call you Abraham. And he left the land of Ur, you know, the land of Ur. Let's go. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
And that comes up later in Genesis 22.
Yeah. That's good.
As well. But it seems like there's God's story and his felt need for the people beyond the Jews.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely think you're right. In fact, Hagar is the first person who names God. That's huge. I mean, just imagine the implications of that, that in the Jewish book, Hagar is the first person to give God a name. That's pretty intense. Staying with your point, there's an interesting, it's on your bibliography, it's a book by Peter Pizzelli. He taught at Harvard for a number of years, and then he branched off to do a number of different psychotherapy work. It's on, gosh, these two handouts, I'm sorry. It's on this handout in the very back, the bibliography. And he has this book called Our Father's Wells, A Personal Encounter with the Myths of Genesis. And he's using myth in the big word, you know, the meta themes of Genesis is what he's working with there. He has a fascinating psychodrama, midrash sort of thing on this very point that this gentleman just mentioned. You want to, let's see, you're going to need this.
And here Ishmael speaks. The best that can be said about their damnable Bible is that they had the temerity to include us, or at least a few of us, in it. Most of us were written out, excised, edited away, forgotten, whole tribes and nations, families, mothers, daughters, and women, particularly women, of whom my mother is an instance, slaughtered by oblivion. Only his lineage and his line remain, great Abraham's. His line and Sarah's, mustn't forget her, now stands in their book as the dominant strain. What a deluded lot, and that's putting it kindly. Some would say demonic. Yes, the best that can be said is that my mother's name is listed, Hagar, and my name with hers, Ishmael. First son and only son of Abram. Abram, he retired that name, disowned himself, his deed, and me. What they did to my mother is unspeakable. Sarah used her, became furiously jealous of her, threw her out, took her back, stole her child, me, and then sent both of us away again. This time she sent us to what would surely have been our deaths had I not found water and killed some game, while my poor mother, in her thirst and terror, heard voices and went mad. Sarah did this. I curse her name. And she and my mother had been close once, almost like sisters. Hagar had been a gift to Sarai, when that was her name, from Pharaoh. She had nursed Sarai back to health after they left Egypt. When Sarai's heart was broken and bitter, they understood each other, even when they fought. But Abram, he was my father. I loved him. I thought he loved me. But in the end, he was weak, pathetic man. Let me tell you how it was, how it really was.
Yeah, compelling, isn't it? Thank you. Yeah, and again, it's it's not for us to necessarily believe it. It's for us to start to imagine a different perspective of the characters in the text. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, wow, you're brave. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's got frailty.
Absolutely. Right.
And stuff going on.
Right. Right.
And I think that's another line of preaching in this.
Yes.
What about these great characters that have every one of them in the scriptures?
Right.
The brokenness and the frailty and the junk going on.
Right. Right. You're brave to preach this. I've never actually preached this text. I've taught it a lot. And it is... you're right. I mean, Abraham's got to be brought down to size somehow. I mean, for him to be real, for him to then be a living expression of faith, as Hebrews, you know, clearly shows him to be. You know, he's got to be somebody that we can emulate, whose shadow we can walk in. All right. You know, Ishmael, a woman came up to me this morning and said a comment after I preached on Moses being rescued from the water. And she said, well, she said, you made Egyptians seem good. You know, she's Egyptian. And she's only heard that story, you know, denouncing Egyptians. And of course, I mean, there's a lot of crummy Egyptians, right? I mean, there's pharaohs of all persuasions out there. But I think we miss, especially us of Caucasian, you know, ethnicity, North Americans, privilege all over the place. I think we miss how powerful it is when a person of a minority hears their story. You know, even if we just hint at it, even if we just say something around Ishmael's longing, his desire, aren't I your son too? Don't I mean anything to you? Even if we just acknowledge and honor that in sermons, what that means. Because, of course, it's not just that minority that we're lifting up. It's all the other oppressed people out there as well. And they start to think, wow, I have a place in this. How did you feel when you heard this little Midrash text? Did it seem kind of inviting? Did you want to kind of linger with Ishmael a little bit and kind of imagine, wow, how does he do it? Or Hagar? I mean, Hagar goes back, right? And interestingly, you know, when they leave again, and this time, you know, she thinks he's going to die. This is a couple of chapters later. Let's see, is that 18 where we're back at? When he leaves again, I'm looking forward here. I didn't mark it in this Bible. But when they leave, when Ishmael goes again this time, you know, because he's playing with Isaac and Sarai again is very threatened, back to that threatened theme, you could do a nice little kind of character study around that. This time, you know, Ishmael's a big guy. You know, he's at least 13. And he could have done a lot, he's older than that. He's definitely older than that, but he could have done a lot of damage. And yet he leaves with his mother. And she's prepared to see him die in the wilderness. And then God comes in, steps in, and gives a profound promise. It's a promise that when you look closely at the wording there is not exactly like the promise made to Abraham and his descendants, but it's a promise of great blessing and a great nation. So somehow to bring Ishmael's story seems really important, especially in kind of our current context as a global society. Yeah, go ahead.
With that in mind, can you speak to what I heard last night, really heard for the first time, was God say to Abraham about Isaac, your son, your only.
Yeah, I didn't prep that story so well for today. There's a couple of really interesting things going on in there. And you could certainly, that is one thing where as Christians, we do have a fuller understanding of that story. But I would say that the sacrifice of your son, your only son, and the image of that coming into Jesus, you know, the only son of God being sacrificed, really starts at the end of the flood narrative. Remember at the end of the flood where the rainbow is in the sky and it's a sign that God will never destroy the earth anymore? The bow that's in the sky is, of course, aimed toward God. Have you ever thought of that? You know, when you draw back a bow and arrow like this and let the arrow fly, the direction of a rainbow, the direction of the arrow goes back to God. And I think there is some images that God has said all along that He will be the one who's going to provide, whether it's providing in the wilderness or providing what will be the end of the sacrificial system. Does that kind of get a little bit, or?
What I'm getting at, no.
Oh, you mean your only son, not Ishmael?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, he calls Isaac his only son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting to explore that. You're right. Sorry, I misinterpreted that remark. You know, it's interesting. Can I just say one quick thing and then I come over to you? You know, it's interesting in that thing because Abraham, the way the Hebrew reads, when Abraham and Isaac come back from the mountain, in the Hebrew text, they leave alone. Isaac does not travel back with Abraham. Isaac goes a different route, and it's a single noun and a single pronoun that the Hebrew uses when they descend the mountain and go on their way. Presumably, we don't have it in the text, any meeting of Isaac and Ishmael again until Abraham dies, and the brothers meet at the father's gravesite to bury their father. And again, there's no warfare between the two. They go on to coexist. Back to the kind of this brotherly rivalry thing that moves throughout. There's a lot of reasons. Why didn't Ishmael just kill him dead when he had a chance? You know, even years later, why didn't he kill him? I think there's some really interesting things in there that restrain Ishmael as much as him and Isaac. Yeah. 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 Did you bring that into your sermon when you preached that?
I did a little, but not very much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. These stories are endless, right? Yeah. Good.
I'm listening to all these stories. I find it delightful to hear because there's a lot of imagination at work here. But at some point in the text, don't we have to come back to the position of where God is at and how He sees it all and how He directs?
Yes. That's right.
And so we have to see how He is unfolding history. Why is He saying Isaac's the only son?
Right.
So it's part of the big picture.
Right. It is. And I appreciate you saying that because we do have to come back to what orthodoxy is and why are we Christians and not Muslim or something else. But I think you get to that in a much richer way after you've kind of explored it more fully. But you're right. We have to come back to what does this mean for us as Christians now? Can we go to the second story for a moment? Okay, so the second story is that Jacob and Esau piece, and I just want to get a read on our time here. Because this is one profound moment in the text here. Let's see. Do we have an extra? I think I just gave mine away. No? I just don't have the NIV up here. This is, of course, the dark night of the soul for Jacob, right? So let's start on this. Can we just kind of split it up in the same way, you know, a couple of paragraphs each or so? Because I think it's helpful to hear it read. So anybody want to just stand? Yeah.
Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is the camp of God." So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob also sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my master Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, men servants and maid servants. Now I am sending this message to my lord that I may find favor in your eyes."
When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds, and camels as well. he thought, if Esau comes to and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape. Then Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper, and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.
He spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds.
He instructed the one in the lead, when my brother Esau meets you and asks, to whom do you belong and where are you going and who owns all these animals to you? Then you are to say, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us.
He also instructed the second and the third and all the others who follow the herds. You are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him. And be sure to say, your servant Jacob is coming behind us. For he thought, I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later when I see him, perhaps he will receive me. So Jacob's gift went on ahead of him, but he spent the night in the camp.
Okay, this is the juiciest part. The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and likewise everything that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? He said, Jacob. Then the man says, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. The sun rose up on him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that's on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. Okay, this is, this is the wrestling match, right, that we've all struggled with. Peter Pizzelli does some really interesting things here about what is it when you meet yourself face to face. Peter Pizzelli is imagining, you know, what is it when you actually look in the mirror and you see who you are? And that's an interesting avenue of kind of exploring this. Jacob, who the text has given us in laborious detail, you know, the trickster who was trying to finagle one more way out. This is the big encounter. He's following God and coming back to see his brother Esau. He had left on the run. He'd been away for at least 12 years. He's on the road back, and he's doing what he's known to do. You know, the same guy who put the hair on his hands and his arms to trick his, you know, almost blind, almost dead dad is the same guy who's thinking, I can do this thing. You know, I can manufacture this. So when you read verse after verse after verse of how many goats and how many sheep and how he arranged it all, I mean, the text is trying to lead us into to remembering this is who this guy was. He was a manufacturer. So now he's stripped of everything. He's alone. And of course, in all sorts of literary images, you know, he's by a brook. There's this liminal line of crossing, you know, some people have already crossed over. He is now the one still on this side. And he meets this, this being. But even in the text, I mean, you may feel absolutely it's God or absolutely like it's an angel, but even in the text, it's pretty nebulous what's going on there. This kind of surrendering, this kind of stripping away, is really elemental to Genesis. We see it on a number of occasions, but we see it here the most expressed, I think. So if you were to try to look at this story from a different angle, what might be some of the preaching paths that you might want to consider? If you were to imagine kind of a whole, I mean, just read the story fresh, what might be some angles you'd use? Yeah.
If Esau receiving the gift and go from the angle of what it's like to get a gift from a brother who's always only taken from you.
Mm.
And even if it is Jacob just trying to pull another muscle, I mean, it's still useful that it wasn't him taking something from him.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, lamenting the fact he's going to meet his brother, he does all kinds of things to try to dissuade that, and finally he has to come through.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of being neglected to find who he really is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That identity piece, I think, is pretty big in this. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm struck by all he did to try to organize and control
it. Right.
Right. You don't need him.
Right. Right. Yeah, go ahead.
On the same line as that, I've been thinking about how he is kind of like that tax collector who gave multiple times more back to those who he cheated.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob is kind of paying for forgiveness in a way that's abundant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
I was a military chaplain. I preached this sermon once on the fog of war.
Oh, that would have been that's a great angle. Yeah. It does. Because, again, yeah, and they're standing for nations here, right? I preached this sermon too, and I did it on Memorial Day. When we honor all those sacrifices that are made. And I found some really interesting things in this wrestling match. One is the word for loin that's used there, that hip socket. In the Hebrew, it's loin, but actually it doesn't really mean the socket here. It's really the groin. And it's the same word that's used, Samson, yeah, I know, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? Where Samson brought forth a son from his own loins. So a whole nother way of understanding this passage that would be very faithful to the text is to see almost the castration of Jacob in this text. That he doesn't going to go away just limping. He is actually, he is stripped of the very manliness. You know, the very virility and vitality of what it means to be a man. So that's a really interesting, it's a wincing. I know when I use it in the sermon, you could see many of the men go, ooh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And for guys who are used to winning, it's a good reminder that he's wrestling with God and he still has that vulnerable spot that God
gives. Yeah, yeah, that's really good. That's right. So when Jacob then goes forward to meet his brother Esau, who remember, Esau is Mr. Virile himself, right? I mean, he is really the man's man. So when Jacob goes forward, Jacob, who's maybe always been a little on the effeminate side, when he goes forward to meet Esau, stripped of the essence of manliness, it makes surrender look a whole lot different, you know?
But what do you do with the fact that
you prevailed? Yeah, interesting. Great segue. In the one that has those midrashes in it, there is a great poem. It's the poem by Rilke. I'll have to just, I hope it's in here. Yeah. Called The Man Watching. And I know I'm talking a lot, but if I can just read this, okay? I can tell by the way the trees bent, after so many dull days on my worried window panes, that a storm is coming. And I hear the far off fields say things, I can't bear without a friend, I can't love without a sister. The storm, the shifter of shapes, drives on across the woods and across time, and the world looks as if it had no age. The landscape, like a line in the psalm book, is seriousness and weight and eternity. What we choose to fight is so tiny. What fights us is so great. If only we would let ourselves be dominated as things do by some immense storm, we would become strong too and not need names. When we win, it's with small things, and the triumph itself makes us small. What's extraordinary and eternal does not want to be bent by us. I mean the angel who appeared in the wrestlers of the Old Testament. When the wrestler's sinews grew long like metal strings, he felt them under his fingers like chords of deep music. Whoever was beaten by this angel, who often simply declined the fight, went away proud and strengthened and great from that harsh hand that kneaded him as if to change his shape. Winning does not tempt that man. This is how he grows, by being defeated decisively by constantly greater beings. Isn't that awesome? I tell you, when I came across that poem about 10 years ago, I almost put it up on my bathroom mirror. Because this idea that what we wrestle against doesn't want to be tamed by us, we're not going to tame God. You know, the hubris of us. But God invites us to go toe-to-toe with him. You know, God invites us to wrestle with him. And if only we would engage with the big things. You know, but we're so satisfied with, like, winning the parking spot, you know, or winning our point in an argument. You know, that, and so we stay small. You know, but going toe-to-toe with God, I mean, being invited into the arena of conversation with God, like Job, you know, books later, now that means something. You know, you go away from that feeling like, I'm still walking. You know, I'm still living. I'm still breathing if I'm Jacob, right?
Walter Brueggemann in the talk being dialogic in a monologic world, mm-hmm. laments the fact that we don't use the laments in worship. And he said some of our praise is monologic and not dialogic.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, Philip Yancey was a longtime member of our church, LaSalle Street Church in Chicago, and he came and did this romp through the scriptures like in an hour. You know, he covered the whole gamut in that way that only a man like Philip Yancey could do. But I remember his comment. He said, you know what? He said, this is the takeaway from me. After reading scriptures over and over and over, after starting from Genesis and going all the way to Revelations just again and again, what I realize is that God just wants people to engage. I mean, you can engage and fall flat on your face, but for heaven's sakes, step up to the plate. You know, pick up a bat in your hand and get into the game. So I think that's the message. You know, for a lot of us, you know, our churches can be filled with people who are all nodding, appreciating the point. You know, but they lack this kind of vitality of their faith. They lack this sense that something's being asked of me and I must respond. You know, I'm being called to do something. A couple of anything we want to just remark on this poem. I just kind of brought it out because Rilke is a wonderful source of great, great stuff. And let me just hit our biographies real quick, our bibliography real quick, and then I want to hit some of those worship practices. I'm not quite sure where our time is. Does anybody know right off?
12:22.
Yeah, shoot. Okay, some that are really good, if you're super academic, that second book, Eric Otterbach's book, Mimesis, is wonderful. And in fact, the introduction by Edward Said in the front is like worth the whole book. So if you can only get it in the library, that's still good. Of course, Walter Brueggemann, his book, Awed to Heaven, Rooted to Earth. If you're doing a preaching series on Genesis, this is a book you just need to have. It's a collection of his prayers that he used as he taught seminary for a number of years, and a lot of them are built on Genesis. Scott Carnes, who I notice is going to be here for the Faith and Writing conference in April, that guy's amazing. If you haven't read his poetry, his work, he is deeply evocative and he is very incarnational. So he's definitely worth reading. John Steinbeck, East of Eden. I know maybe you were subjected to it in high school and haven't read it since then. It's so worth it. It's so worth it. This whole idea of Cain and Abel being played out, you know, in today in Salinas, California is just great. Another one, just to move down there, Bill Moyers, that Genesis, A Living Conversation. That is not putsy stuff. You know, it's kind of easy to think, oh, that was on, you know, just public television. What do they really have to tell us too much about the deep meaning of the text? It's awesome. Because what Moyers did is that he gathered a group of rabbis and scholars around him, and he had conversations. It was really kind of like the early kind of text stuff that the church used to do. You know, what does this mean? And then we all sit and talk about it. So that's a wonderful book, too. I think I've mentioned those others. A couple of other good resources just to bring out. One, I'm just going to play you this story, this song by the Mountain Goats, because we didn't get to a whole page here. It's that page where I say, hold on, where I have those unexpected voices, Ham and Shem. Remember them? Moses' sons who, you know, like are doomed because they try to cover up Moses' genitalia. Or sorry, not Moses, Noah's genitalia. That's an interesting one. Leah, remember she's the kind of scorned wife, the one who was never really loved by her husband. Hagar and Ishmael, we touched on that. Esau, we didn't really get to him. He's an interesting guy. Abimelech, you know, he's the one who seems to know more about the purposes of God than Abraham does. Remember, Abraham passes off Sarah as a sister, and it's Abimelech who says, wait a minute, what are you doing? You know, he has a sensitivity to this God of the Hebrews that, you know, Abraham's largely clueless about. So let me just play this one song here, and because I really just, hold on, I just kind of want to show some different ways of engaging your worship practices on this. So this is Leah. Yes. Oh, I think I know what to do. Wait. That's not it. Oh, if I only had a teenage boy that could, like, be attached to me at all times, you know? Okay, here we go. You've got your text in this handout where the bibliography is. No, the other one. This is Genesis 33.
For several days, the visitors were here. We saw them turn down, watched them disappear. Talked about the days they said were sure to come. Had a hard time believing. I remember seeing you, my tongue struck dumb, when you first came here, from wherever it was you came from. The power in your voice, rough touch, you keeping care of me, keeping watch, open up the doors to the tent, wonder where the good times went. I will do what you ask me to do, because of how I feel about you. Forever. Several hours we lay there, last ones of our kind. Harder days coming, maybe, I don't mind. Sounds kind of dumb when I say it, but it's true. I would do anything for you. Open up the promise of the day. Drive the dark things away. I will do what you ask me to do, because of how I feel about you.
When we start to imagine these texts from other voices, it really opens you up to a whole different kind of exploratory work that I think oftentimes we kind of settle for just the way we think the text reads or what we think the text says, instead of really trying to engage with the people of the text, you know, and what they meant. If I could just point your attention to one other thing here, and that's those worship practices, because I think if you were to do a series on Genesis, and I'm assuming that most of you are in here because you're either a preacher or a teacher and trying to consider whether this might be a good thing for y'all to do in church. There's some really nice things. We didn't touch on blessing, but of course blessing is enormous in the book of Genesis. Both the power of a blessing, the understanding that a blessing brings into being, you know, something that is only nascent right now. I had a very powerful example of that. Frank Thomas, the man who's preaching tonight, was my homiletics professor. And I remember the first sermon I preached for that guy. And I had been kind of like bashed all my sermons up to then. I was already in the ministry, already preaching, and this was an advanced preaching class. And I remember the sermon I preached, and I remember him saying, "Wow, that was great." It was the first time I'd ever heard, "Wow, that was great." And then he proceeded to break it down for me. You know, "That was great. Here's how it could have been better," you know, which is all what we need to hear. But I think blessing and affirmation somewhere, you know, have a relationship together that the people really need to hear. You know, people in my church, mostly they don't need to be yelled at anymore. You know, people have been yelling at them their whole lives, you know. They need to hear, "No, God is so desperately in love with you and has created you so perfectly." So this idea of blessing, I think, could be a very profound element to incorporate weekly as you preach through Genesis. And then I have just some ideas of activities there, some of which we've done in our church, some of which were better than others. I'll just FYI on that, strips of fabric tied to the looms and then fans blowing them. It's really not all that great. I mean, maybe it'll work in your church. It was just kind of a little odd, you know. But there have been others there that were pretty good. And also, if you do Genesis as a study group, a very powerful moment is to have folks who have now been together for 8 or 10, 12 weeks, to have them bless each other. You know, because a blessing, as it's crafted in the book of Genesis, is that it pulls from something that is already in the person, you know, and then it extrapolates that into the future and what God would do with it. So that can be pretty powerful. And then this idea of call. You know, I don't know what your composition of your churches is. We have a church of about half who are under 30. They're always wondering, "What's God's will for my life?" You know, so it's been interesting. In fact, Reverend Orion Trickey, who's here too, she's on our staff as well, and she's put together listening groups, and they're groups that just hear each other and discern together. That's a practice that we Protestants, I think, could really use to recover. There's a wonderful book there. I didn't put it in my bibliography, but that "Let Your Life Speak" by Parker Palmer is a wonderful one, and Listening Hearts as well. And then this idea of toe-to-toe with God, this gets back to those prayers of lament, you know, that this idea that God just wants us to show up and show up with our full being and engage at every level. So one of our best series, I'd say, in church really started with this searching questions, that last little bullet point there, A woman preached a sermon that asked a lot, or she just articulated a lot of the questions that she's had about God. And then in our response time, people wrote their own questions. This is what's really been bothering me. This is really the question. And it was all anonymous. So, you know, they could say whatever, as far out as it was. And it ranged from things like, you know, I've never really felt forgiven, to all sorts of things. I mean, how do I really engage with my Muslim neighbor? Is he really going to hell? I mean, it was the whole gamut of that stuff, you know. But we use that as the basis then for a whole series on tough questions. So you can get at some really good stuff, at real felt need stuff, you know, whole life engagement stuff, using some of these practices as well. Well, it's 11:30. You know, one thing, or I'm sorry, 12:30. I'm still in Central Time. The themes of Genesis, I just kind of, you know, at a different point, I thought we might all have Bibles, we would just kind of look at, see where some of these themes apply through the book of Genesis. There's just some really good things in there, and I'm, you know, just use this as a starting off point for your imaginations. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Or sorry, that was so brief. Yeah, thank you. It was really fun. Thanks. And if you're interested in looking at some of these resources, I'll just have them all up here.